This episode of Practical Significance is brought to you by Sitel. Sitel is a global leader in cutting-edge analytical solutions, quantitative methods, and innovative statistical software for the life sciences industry. For nearly four decades, Sitel has pioneered adaptive trial design using data-driven insights to inform strategy across all phases of drug development and commercialization. Sitel continues to drive innovation in clinical research by accelerating drug development, improving success rates, and delivering better patient outcomes. Headquartered in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Sitel has more than 2,000 employees worldwide.
Hello, and welcome to Practical Significance, a podcast to inspire listeners with compelling stories from statistics and data science and to propel data-driven careers forward. Here are your hosts, the ASA's Director of Strategic Initiatives, Donna Lalonde, and Executive Director, Ron Wasserstein.
Well, welcome to Practical Significance. We're actually continuing our theme of celebrating ASA presidents because we have ASA past presidents with us today to offer some career advice. We're particularly excited at the ASA to be launching ASA Career Connect, so we hope that you check that out as well. So we thought it was a good time to mine the incredible expertise of Shastri Pantula and Wendy Martinez, and we're going to start by asking them to tell us a little bit about their day jobs and to share a really important moment, a pivotal moment that led to a new path or to a new opportunity. And Shastri, we'll start with you.
Thank you again for having me. I am really excited. Being a dean of the College of Natural Sciences is one of the best jobs to have in academia. It is really the best job when you get excited seeing our students being successful. You know, student success is our number one priority. I really get the gratification seeing our faculty being successful because they are the key for our students' success and for our discoveries. I get really thrilled when our staff, who are the invisible backbone with incredible impact, are successful. I'm so proud when our alumni, our administration, our community are thriving, and we are helping with the social mobility. So in other words, it is the best job if you're excited about seeing people around you reaching their full potential. So my main job, day job, is to be a cheerleader and find the resources for all of us to reach our goals. So now you asked me about the pivotal moment. For me, the pivotal moment came in 1994. I was just promoted to full professor, and I was actually at JSM in Toronto. I got the news that our director of graduate programs at NC State, Tom Gehrig, a very good friend of mine, he has been promoted to being the department head. So I left the joint statistics meetings a day early to come back to Raleigh to convince him why he should select me as the director of graduate programs. I love teaching. I love working with students. I love spending time with them, mentoring, playing cards, racquetball, etc. So he gave me the job. And that was a pivotal moment for me. And I never looked back being an administrator from then onwards. From there, I moved to be the department head, ASA president, NSF division director, dean at Oregon State for 4 years, and now dean at Cal State San Bernardino for almost 7 years. Did I say I love my job? Did I say I love students? I'll stop there.
That's great, Shastri. Thanks so much. And so, Wendy, over to you.
So, Donna, you asked about our day job. So I am a senior mathematical statistician for data science at the U.S. Census Bureau. That's always a big mouthful for me to say that phrase, but it is a fun job. I don't know if it's as much fun as what Shastri was mentioning in his day job, but still we do a lot of cool things. This is a senior technical position, which means that I get to do a wide range of different things, going all the way from, say, starting level tasks like doing some actual computer coding in R to being a senior advisor on research projects. Sastry, you said something that resonated with me, and I'm sure others. And this was at the JSM, the one in DC right after COVID. Was that 2022? Anyway, we had a mentoring panel, and you were on the mentoring panel. We were supposed to answer a question about our mentoring experiences and things. And I never thought I would be a good mentor. And so I sort of resisted being a mentor, but Donna got me involved in that and I really loved it. But one of the things you said, Sastry, was that many different relationships can be mentoring, like your family can mentor you and, you know, your colleagues, and you could have informal mentoring relationships. So you've really inspired me that way to be a mentor. And I get to do that at the Census Bureau. So that's really super exciting. And I also get to do some training. So I get to teach. Some of the courses I do are training in R, data science, data ethics. I guess I have as much fun as Sastry, but from a different viewpoint because it is the federal government. Pivotal moment. I guess the one that comes to mind is, I guess it was about 15 years ago. I was working for a Department of Defense agency and they were undergoing a reduction in force. And that's always kind of frightening, as listeners can imagine. But I felt like I would be all right, that I wouldn't lose my job because I had, you know, time in service and other considerations. But I felt that I had qualifications that I could go look for another job and perhaps save a position for somebody else. So I used that as a motivation to look for other opportunities, and that did lead to a career in the federal statistical system, which eventually led to, you know, management opportunities, supervisory opportunities, and my position eventually here at the Census Bureau. So even though it was a scary situation that was going on, you know, I was able to turn that into an opportunity.
Well, thank you. Donna and I are both very happy that our day jobs put us in contact with you guys. It's been great to work with you over the years. Now I got to ask you to dig back deep into the recesses of your mind, get in the Wayback Machine, hop into the time traveling DeLorean, whatever it takes, but go all the way back to first job seeking, because we're looking to get advice for our listeners. What are the common pitfalls that first-time job seekers should be aware of, and how can they navigate early challenges in the job search process? So let's go the other way around this time and start with Wendy.
All right, thanks, Ron. I just would like listeners to keep in mind that the context for my comments is for U.S. government jobs. However, some of the tips and the pitfalls I'm going to mention apply to jobs in any sectors. And in fact, the first pitfall I'll mention does apply. So be sure you don't limit yourself when you look at the qualifications in the job announcements. Oftentimes we think, oh, I don't satisfy all those requirements. I don't check all the boxes. So you don't apply for the job. If you have, like, say, 8 out of the 10 required knowledge and skills and you'd be interested in the job, then apply for it. The lists that hiring managers provide in the announcements sometimes are for a perfect world, and they know they're likely will not get someone with all those qualifications. So don't let that stop you. In particular, with federal jobs and resumes, do not limit yourself to 1 or 2 pages. I know as, like, recent graduates and you're looking for your first job, they say just 1 or 2 pages. Don't do that. You're not limited with that with federal jobs. You don't want to write a book, but give yourself some room. And the reason is because human resource personnel screen applications, and they do that by looking at your resumes. So you need to clearly state your job experience you have. If you have any, use volunteer experience, list the responsibilities, the achievements, the number of weekly hours, and so on. Also, don't limit yourself with respect to the job titles that you're searching for. So don't just look for statistician jobs or data scientist or mathematician. Other job titles might be appropriate. For example, operations research analyst is really just another title for a statistician in some government agencies. Next, it's really important to look at any education requirements to qualify for the job. You don't necessarily need a degree in statistics, say, to be qualified or certified as a statistician. For example, you might qualify as a statistician with an economics degree or an education degree. Again, look at the education requirements in the job listing because sometimes you just need a certain number of, say, statistics classes or math classes. And this leads me to another point about your resume. You should be clear on your resume that you've had the required classes to qualify for that occupation. And sometimes courses have strange names. For example, let's say there's a class called Modeling in the New Age, and that might really be considered a statistics class or computer science. However, the human resource specialists that are screening your resume to qualify you probably don't know this and will not count it as one of your required classes. So again, be very clear on your resume. And then final point, as I recommend that you tailor your resume to the job announcement. You could put keywords in your resume that helps the human resource specialist make the connection between the experience, the education that you have, and what is specified in the job announcement.
Thank you, Wendy. That's excellent advice. First and foremost, is to be very confident about the excellent skills you have. I mean, this should show up, like you said, in your resume. It should show up in your interview, and it should show up in your passion for teaching and research if you are coming into academia. Again, it should show up in your communication and in your negotiation skills. Many a times, I have seen very good candidates, especially minorities, first-generation students, and low-income students, have struggles getting over their imposter syndrome. So I encourage you to seek help early, whether it be from your advisor, your mentor, your seniors, or a counselor. I mean, you're not alone, and there is help all around us. So make use of the help to get over that. I would also encourage you to start early in your PhD program, maybe to start tutoring, be a TA, maybe teach a class. I mean, that was one thing at Iowa State I did, teach a class in the summer that gave me the confidence as well as the confidence to people who are looking at me that I could teach. Attend JSM. I encourage that. Present your work. Practice, practice, practice. And of course, network. Know what makes you tick and know what ticks you off. Remember also that you may not get every job you applied for or interviewed for. I mean, at the end of the day, it is really about finding a good match. I mean, just like when your papers get rejected by a journal, you revise, improve, and find a suitable journal to publish it. We learn from our experiences. I recall my advisor once said to me, "Sastry, you only see the papers that got published, and you don't see how many of my papers got rejected." So I just want you to know, don't ever give up. Don't ever, ever give up. And I wish you the best.
Thanks, Sastry. I'm actually going to tag on to that with the next question because you mentioned networking, and actually Wendy talked about it also in terms of the mentoring. So I want to get from both of you maybe a little bit more on how important networking has been in your career evolution, but also some strategies for building those valuable connections. And Sastry, start with you.
Yeah, thank you. I could not imagine where I am without networking, without developing a broad network of allies and sponsors. I want to credit my advisor, Wayne Fuller. He's a well-known statistician and a former ASA vice president, Founders Award recipient, a wonderful man. He used to make sure, as students, as well as when I was a junior faculty member, we attended JSM. More importantly, attend the opening mixer. We used to hang around with him at the opening mixer. And he's like a magnet. Who is who in statistics would stop by to talk to Wayne? And the important thing is he made sure he introduced us to them and bragged about us. Those connections in my fledgling years really, really paid off. So I encourage you to attend every JSM and don't forget to spend time at the opening mixer and meet lots of people. and it is the place for networking. So another strategy I want to mention also is to overcome my shyness or being an introvert, and I hide my insecurities well, is to volunteer. I was volunteering in the ASA local chapter in North Carolina, volunteered to be an officer in the business and economic statistics section, volunteered to be an associate editor or a treasurer for ASA, volunteered to be a mentor for the diversity and mentoring program. This kind of forced myself to be with people and get over being an introvert or worried about being with strangers. I also learned a lot about myself. I mean, that I truly get joy and gratification by helping others. That really helped me the most in gaining allies and sponsor who recommended me in rooms I'm not in or the positions I've been fortunate to be in. So I'm very grateful to many people who continue to help me with my success. So networking is not only important to meet people, but also you must continue to nurture that relationship and keep in touch with them. I mean, keep informed of what is going on with you, and also more importantly, genuinely listen to what is happening with them. So again, I'm in favor of networking and getting mentoring at any stage of our life.
Thanks, Sastry. That's great advice. Find a person who is a statistics magnet and volunteer. I mean, yes, that's wonderful. Wendy, what would you like to add in terms of networking strategies and how it's maybe impacted your career?
Yeah, thank you, Donna. When I was thinking about these questions, it took me a little bit to think about networking in my career, because usually getting a job in the, well, almost always getting a job in the federal government involves a lot of, you know, procedures, policies, fairness, rules and laws that have to be followed. And so you have to apply for the job. And then, as I said earlier, it gets screened by the HR person before the hiring manager ever gets it. So I guess what I'm getting at is there's really not a mechanism for just, say, somebody I network with or I'm friends with to just give me a job, because you have to go through these procedures. So that made me wonder, well, how has networking helped me? And it has helped me in several instances that I wasn't really aware of, I guess, at the time. And so it has been very important. It was through networking that I became aware of and pursued a new PhD program. Eventually, I got my PhD. That, of course, that led to my dissertation advisor facilitating a detail for me at the Office of Naval Research. I was a program officer where I got to develop, fund, and lead research projects. That detail eventually led to a full-time job there at ONR. And I think by continuing to network through many of the mechanisms that Sastry mentioned, people started to know me. I had professional colleagues. That led to several, many fantastic opportunities to serve our professional communities in various ways, and eventually led to my current job at the Census Bureau. Knowing these people, I think you get a reputation, and that certainly helps you in the interviews, job applications, and experience, and all of that. And as Sastry, I think, mentioned too, it's not just networking to get a job, but it's also to have satisfaction in your professional life, you know, to be a mentor, to get mentoring and coaching. So it's all of that. So I'll just finish with strategies. Getting involved with a professional organization like the American Statistical Association will just really give you lots of opportunities with your colleagues, and especially getting involved with sections. There's many sections that cover different areas of interest. There's sure to be something that you would be interested in joining and working with those folks, like have a sense of community, volunteer, run for section office, give talks, go to the conferences, organize seminars, you know, build your professional community, because they will help you.
Thank you both. So now let's get to that point where the rubber meets the road and you have a job interview. What's some advice you would give to someone as they prepare for an interview? Wendy, why don't you go first this time?
All right, thanks. This is one of the scariest parts, is doing the interview. First of all, I would recommend that you practice. Get colleagues, family members to give you mock interviews. Practice in your head, I guess, mentally rehearse. Gather example interview questions and then have answers ready. Research the company or agency that you're interviewing with so you know what they do, what they're all about, what is their mission. And I remember one time I was applying for a job. This was after the reduction in force. I was interviewing for a job, and I think it was with HUD, and they asked me about their department or their office, and I had really no clue, so I really fumbled that one. And of course, they didn't pursue anything because that was a fundamental piece of homework that I should have done. And I think this helps with my next piece of advice, which is they often ask you why you want to work for them or why they should hire you. So this helps you have an answer ready for that question. Also, be prepared with questions you can ask of them. And here I think you have to be a little bit careful because I don't recommend asking questions about, oh, what are you necessarily going to do for me in terms of, say, promotion or those kinds of things. But ask questions that shows that you're interested and want to be invested in their agency or their company. So, for example, maybe you could ask a question about, well, are there opportunities for me to develop, you know, advance my education or something, because it shows then that you're interested in developing yourself, which then helps the agency or the company. And finally, you might have answered questions in your application regarding your skills, or maybe you mentioned things that you've done in the resume. So for example, maybe you said, oh, I have experience writing R or Python programs. Well, be prepared to give supporting examples of that type of experience, or maybe experiences where you've led a team or where you tried some piece of research and it didn't work out. And what did you learn from that, or how did you handle that? So sometimes answering questions about your soft skills, it's also good to prepare for those.
Thanks, Wendy. So Sastry, what advice do you have on?
First and foremost, learn about the position and the place you're planning to interview at. My younger days, when it is punch cards and no cell phones, nowadays, there is a lot of information about everything on internet or on social media. So there's absolutely no excuse not to know a lot about the place you're applying to. So do your homework about the university or the company or the organization you're applying to. I was advising somebody about the dean's job. I mean, you can even ask ChatGPT to ask what questions to expect. You just give the position description and ask what type of questions can I expect. You can even give the committee members' names to see what they may ask. Or you can give your CV in addition to that and ask, hey, what should be my answers be? Of course, I did this for the podcast too. I asked, what should I answer, right? Anyway, if you're applying to an academic job, usually it involves you meeting the search committee, some of the faculty individually. You meet the chair, you meet the dean, you meet the students, present a seminar on your research. And in some places like ours, we also ask the person to give a lecture to students. We want to see how you are with the students. We will send you the schedule ahead of time so you can do your research and be prepared. Again, as Wendy said, practice your talk, time your talk, allow time for questions. Don't have 100 PowerPoint slides for a 30-minute talk. Make sure your slides are readable. Make sure that you use a font size that is readable by old folks like me. Tell stories. Make sure you have good questions for the chair and the dean. And no, don't ask about your salary. That will come later when you're selected. I'll stop.
Thank you, Sasha. I just want to say before we move on that we use ChatGPT to figure out who our guests should be on this podcast. So it's all working out just fine.
That's good.
I was going to say that I feel like we've arrived, that our podcast is a prompt to ChatGPT, right? Okay, so Wendy, you mentioned at the beginning, so I'm going to start with you, the notion of really clarifying what your skills are on the resume. So if an HR person is reviewing, it's clear. But you also said that when you read a job description, don't feel like 100% of the qualifications have to be met. So I'm going to push us in that direction a little bit and say, what advice would you offer for someone who's transitioning to a different role or industry and being able to identify and leveraging the transferable skills? So how do you take what you have and make it fit, make it be compelling for a new industry? So Wendy, we'll start with you.
Thank you. I really love this question because sometimes of the words describing a skill or a role, especially if it's in another industry or area, it's different as you just mentioned. And so I think it goes back to what we said at the beginning, think broadly, don't constrain or limit yourself. Try to map your skill into what they're asking for. And have someone help you with crafting how your skills transfer, because it's similar to when you'd have to do self-evaluations. And sometimes when we're looking at ourselves, we have a narrow focus. And sometimes it helps then to have somebody else say, well, I think you did X, Y, Z. And then you realize, oh, yeah, I did do that. I should put that in my evaluation or count it here or whatever. So I think it's a similar thing with skills. So for example, maybe in your job, you're not necessarily a manager or a supervisor or a team lead, but maybe with what you're doing, you'd have those skills and you just don't think of them that way. And so you can then map them into maybe a managerial position if that's what you're looking for. Having somebody else kind of help you think broadly about that, I think, is helpful. I think you should consult someone in the other industry or has that other role for help and advice. So, for example, if I was moving to academia, I could contact Sastry and get help from him about, how might my skills transfer to academia. And so this is where mentoring, again, and networking can really help you. And I'll just conclude my response on this with just to mention an online resource that's published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that's called the Occupational Outlook Handbook. So you could just on a search engine or go to the BLS.gov, search Occupational Outlook Handbook. It has descriptions of different occupations, different levels of jobs in that occupation, the skills you need, expectations, what would your job be like, and what's the job outlook 10 years ahead. So check that out. It might be a good resource on, figuring out what skills you need for a different job, role, or industry.
Thanks, Wendy. Sastry, what would you add to that?
Statisticians have a leg up on this since our core communication, computational, collaborative, consulting, critical thinking skills are transferable from academia to industry to government work. I was really, really glad that my dean, Dan Solomon, another well-known statistician, Founders Award winner, insisted that I go to an industry for my sabbatical leave. I went to Semitech in Austin to do my sabbatical leave. It really helped me gain a new experience. Instead of going to another university, it broadened my mind. I could bring the experience to my classroom. Then I also worked for federal government. I worked for NSF for 3 years. Again, the networking that Wendy talked about really, really helps. What I found in my teaching, that critical thinking and leadership experience are useful in all of these jobs, whether you're in industry or academia or government. And also, I believe that my core values about striving for excellence, enhancing diversity, fostering harmony carries over to all sectors. Again, I also want to come back encouraging people to attend JSM. I can't emphasize that enough. It is the mecca for information and networking. You will see people under one big tent from all sectors and all experiences, and you can learn a lot from others at JSM and about the careers in statistics. Of course, I encourage my students and others to read Amstat News, read Significance. Of course, listen to this wonderful podcast.
Thank you both. Thank you so much. So looking back over your careers now, would you share a time when you needed to take a risk in your career? And what did you learn from that? And Sastry, over the years, I've heard you tell some good stories. So let me start with you.
Thank you, Ron. Again, when you suffer from imposter syndrome, every career move is a challenge and feels very risky. Every time I do that, I feel scared. I mean, let me share one experience. So when I got my first airport interview for a dean's job, I spent days and days preparing for it. I learned every single thing about the institution, everything about every single member on the committee, and I prepared why I am the best for their job. So my first question at the airport interview in Atlanta was a softball question. So they asked, Sastry, why are you interested in this job? Why now? What experiences prepared you for this job? Oh boy, was I ready for it. I was so thrilled to hear that question. I gave a 25-minute response that I prepared for connecting every single experience I had, how it connects to this job, and how it connects to each person by name on that committee, giving some citations to their own work, etc. I really nailed it. I mean, of course, they had other questions, but we had less time, and I thought I answered them adequately. And I ran out of time for asking the 10 questions I was going to ask each committee member individually. I was flying back from Atlanta Airport. I still recall this very well, feeling mighty good and patting on my own back for the excellent preparation I did and what a great job I did in the interview. Of course, I didn't get called for the campus interview. So I was devastated. I recall going to Dan Solomon again and telling him about this. And he also told me, Sastry, sometimes you give it all without having a safety net and you don't know how to take when you're rejected, which is true. I give more than 100% for anything that I'm trying to do. So failure is kind of hard on me. So later on, I checked with the committee member how I could improve. And he told me that I lost the interview on my first response. I'm supposed to give a brief answer to the point, kind of get them started, and wait for other 10 questions to bring all of the things that I brought it up in the first question. But I didn't know that I will have 10 questions. Nobody told me that. So now I make sure every search committee, make sure that the search committee, the first thing that they tell the candidates is how the Zoom interview is structured, with 10 or so questions, each taking 3 to 5 minutes, and time for you to ask questions at the end. As I said, you learn from every experience, and not everything you try necessarily will be successful at the first attempt, but it's a good learning experience.
Thank you for sharing that, Sastry. That's really appreciated. Wendy, how about something from your experience?
I tend to be risk averse in some situations, but career-wise, two instances come to mind. I already mentioned the agency where I was working about 15 years ago that was undergoing a reduction in force. And as I said, I used that as an opportunity to look for a new job. And before that time, I'd never been a supervisor. And I didn't think I had it in me to be a supervisor. I didn't think I would be a good supervisor. And it was a bit frightening to me. And I had to, you know, do a lot of different job applications. Eventually, I was interviewed for several. And then one of the jobs was at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And it was a supervisory job. And so it was a bit frightening to think about taking the job, but it had some good things about it that was exciting. And I realized that I was limiting myself. And I think it's what Sastry was mentioning, imposter syndrome. I think that's part of it. But I just didn't think I had the right skills to be a supervisor or that I would be good at it. But I took a risk and I accepted the job. But it turned out that I liked it. I think I was a good supervisor. I was a supervisor there for over 10 years. So I took a risk and it was a turning point in my career. And then the second risk I took was not in my paid job, but in volunteer job with the American Statistical Association because I was nominated for president of the ASA and subsequently elected, which was a fantastic opportunity. But just agreeing to run, accepting the nomination, was really scary because it is an important job. There's, I don't know, Ron, how many members in the association?
15,000. Wendy, and I'm just going to jump in to say that I remember talking to you about it, and you were absolutely convinced you would not get elected.
I know. Wow. Yes. And of course, one of the scariest things was, oh, I'd have to do a speech, right? And so, but I told myself, are you going to let that stop you from doing it? Don't let your fear stop you. And so I didn't. And thanks to encouragement, Ron and others, I was elected, and it was one of the best experiences. It was in a tough year, but we all pulled together and got through it. And when I look back, the risks I took were scary at the time because either I didn't think I was well qualified, or I didn't think I'd be good at it, or I really didn't want to do it. However, they turned out to be really the best choices I ever made, the most rewarding experiences. And of course, the most fun ever. Don't limit yourself in what you're doing. Don't be scared. You are worthy and you should just go for it.
Those were fantastic answers. We are so grateful to both of you for sharing all of the insights that you shared throughout the podcast. But we have a tradition, and that tradition is the guests have to add to Donna's TBR list. So we are going to end by asking you what you're reading, listening to, watching. Everything is fair game. So Sastry, what's on your TBR list or watching list or listening list?
So my reading these days is limited to reading what's happening in the higher education. So I read The Chronicle of Higher Education, Inside Higher Ed, of course, the Amsterdam News. Even those, I'm getting a bit lazy. I dump them in ChatGPT to get 10 bullet summary before I read any article, whether I want to invest time in it or not. So my reading is very limited. I'm reading right now promotion and tenure files. I enjoy theater and recently saw Back to the Future and I saw Kimberly Akimbo. I also must say, I really, really enjoyed the Grammys the other day. I thought this great show.
Well, Wendy, it's insider baseball with me asking you this question because I actually know a little bit about what you're reading and listening to and watching, but share with our listeners.
Yeah, that's intriguing, Donna, because I don't know if I'm going to answer what you think I'm going to answer. But so Donna and I are co-editors of Chance Magazine, published by the ASA and Taylor Francis. And so Donna and I are always looking for good articles, and we've been getting a lot of them in. And so I've been supposed to be reading the articles. That's a lot of fun doing that. So that's one thing. The other thing I'll just say is I've become addicted to Kickstarter. And I might need an intervention. I've backed like over 135 projects on Kickstarter, and most of them are books. So I do think I'll need an intervention. My TBW, so to be watched, I highly recommend The Great British Baking Show. I'm very addicted to it, and I just find it comforting to watch. It's on Netflix. I guess I could say that. Yeah, maybe I like it because most of my memories and my mapping, I guess, in my head is related to food. So I love it and you should watch it.
Okay, so I was not surprised. I guess that's good.
Good.
We just really want to thank both of you for sharing such wonderful advice. And we want to remind folks that they can get even more advice by checking out the new ASA Career Connect.
So this month's episode is happening in a couple of parts so that we could have three wonderful guests. And so today I'm joined by Satrajit, who is the chair of the SPAG committee. And I'm going to leave it to him to tell you a little bit about SPAG, but we're going to start by asking you to tell us about your day job.
Thanks, Donna, for the nice introduction, and thanks, Kim, for the invitation. So my name is Satrajit Roy-Chaudhary. I'm a biostatistician in Pfizer. I am in pharmaceutical career for last 16 years, and I have moved to many different roles during my career, starting from a trial statistician. The statistician involved day-to-day business with the trial, moving into more scientific and more strategic groups like consulting across groups, where basically we come across to two statistical scientific problem which we try to solve with collaboration with multifunctional groups together. This career has always been a great role. I mean, I have been mentored by ASA mentors, and I also been worked with many of the ASA working group, which were phenomenal for me over my career. I must say they played a role. So currently, what me and my group use, we are a consulting group within pharmaceutical company. Now it's a standard group within all big pharma companies that we have a statistic consulting group who work across different therapeutic area. So, you know, the regular day job of a statistician, usually they are engaged with a particular therapeutic area in general. But a group like us, we work across different therapeutic area. We across different teams. When there is a problem arise, which is not a traditional statistical problem that they do in a day-to-day job. I mean, it's kind of a little bit out of box, and they arise quite often if when I look into across the board for the nature of the clinical trial, the nature of how the medicine is developing, how healthcare is developing, how the science is developing, quantitative problems are becoming complex as well. So in order to cope with that, we kind of work with the team in our daily, we consult with them what kind of quantitative methodology would be adequate to address their needs in this trial, what kind of computation tools they may need. So we often collaborate with the teams to develop those. Sometime we develop kind of an some of the material that we develop, we kind of we try to fit onto another project based on the similarity on the project. So I would say a lot of communication is a huge part of our role. And then of course the technical expertise remain, which I presume most statisticians are more favorite part, but of course we also do a lot of external engagement on different zones of the world. We have people in Europe, China, as well as in US, where we across the globe we keep our connection with the scientific community, the statistical community, and try to learn and also kind of disseminate our knowledge in order to consolidate them or make it more acceptable industry-wise.
So, Satrajit, I'm going to ask you to think back to the beginning of your career, but also to share some of the insights that you've gained throughout the career and give some advice for either first-time job seekers or folks who are transitioning to a new role, how to navigate the challenges of the job search process.
Absolutely. I think that's very critical. And at the beginning of my career, I'm now interviewing people for a long time, which is also part of our regular job. We evaluate talent within the group. We mentor talent. I would always recommend few things to the new career. I will start with the new career seekers, and then I move into the people who are transitioning onto that zone. Whenever I work with people, I go to academia or I talk to people, I try to recommend the student one thing very firmly, that when you apply for a job, focus on that job. Don't think about like all job is one job, like a generic job of a statistician, because often we have seen this mistake done by early career people. They think about like a generic CV and try to float it around with everybody. And then I keep telling them that's one of the dangerous thing to do. When they apply for a job, they should study the job, understand what the job needs are, and make their CVs highlighting some of the needs that should be reflected in this. What are the key skills that job is asking for? It's not like what are your achievements only, but how that fits. The whole idea of the CV is when a reviewer look into that, they understand that, okay, this person can bring a value to the organization when we bring them in. And highlighting that into the CV is very, very important. I often still see people are, unfortunately, use of some of the recent tools. I'm seeing people generating CV with this language models and stuff. I mean, things becoming more generic, but it's very important to personalize them and look into the description, bring it into with that. Second thing for statistician, soft skills are equally important. The soft skill, both in terms of team working, in both writing and speaking, in terms of these things are very important skills to have. Because when a person comes into a clinical trial, he has to work with a clinician, scientist, a regulator, and some of the folks who are just site monitor, no clue about science. They are looking into the how patients are getting the drug, but we have to communicate with all of them on this time. And it's very important team playing that has to come in. None of us know everything. We learn on everyday job. At least me, I learn every day. I'm fortunate enough to work on COVID-19 vaccine trial, which was kind of a huge learning for me. And that's also like 10 or 12 years after my career. It was a huge learning on that context. So they have to keep their mind open. They have to learn to communicate with everybody and talk to everybody to understand that what people need. And without a good soft skill, that is very difficult to have. And of course, the power of networking. I mean, they should not forget that. I mean, it's very important. I mean, networking is so powerful to know people, to know the community, what other does. I mean, when I'm trying to focusing on the job helps quite a bit when you know people. I mean, in my career, I was a mathematician in training. I become interested in biostatistics when I was first time went to Toronto JSM in 2004. And I learned so much beautiful research there. I involved in the biopharmaceutical. I went to the mixer. I talked with many people. Slowly the interest developed for me on there. And it replicated in 2005 in Minnesota JSM when I was there. I mean, I think these events were phenomenal and students should learn from them. In their early career phase, this really plays a huge role, the networking, understanding. And the last thing I always say, I mean, don't get disheartened by the criticism. I mean, the criticism comes in. We all don't know everything. And I see them get down with the criticism and they take it too personally. I mean, people have perspective. Try to learn from it and go ahead. There is no one right or wrong. Understanding perspective and putting it onto that perspective, that's what they need to learn on that time. And I think for transitioning career in my life, I did several times. I mean, first, we just need to know what we are transitioning on. Because sometimes people just transition because they think and they heard this is very shiny. First, to know about that job is very important. And also see how much of the current talent can be transferable. Of course, the soft skill and other things are transferable. Some of the technical things are transferable. But also, it's critical to learn further. I mean, when I moved to this job after trial statistician for 7, 8 years, I moved to this job that was back, I was in Novartis. It was a huge learning curve for me, how to do consulting, how to be an effective consultant to a team. That's a learning, and I need to go through several material trainings in order to achieve that. There is no end of learning. So transferring job, there is a lot of things we know, but there is also some things we need to learn on the same time. Need to have that agility and the flexibility in the mind.
That's just such a wonderful answer. And, as you were talking about your early experience with JSMs, it just actually really occurred to me that networking is something that one has to do throughout their entire career, right? You are never too late in your career to network. So that's really wonderful advice. So I want to move a little bit from the application process, but I hope people really hear you in terms of the tailoring the CV and get your insights on the interview process. Any tips for preparing for the interview that you would like to share?
When a person comes for interview, they need to be 100% committed to why they're applying for that job. It's very important they read the job descriptions. Most of the companies, I mean, they try to be at least pretty specific about what are these people need to do day to day. Of course, there are additional works. There are other types of work, but majority of the duties are actually listed there to understand that. And then, of course, learning about that company a little bit at least, that what they do, what kind of priorities they have. So I work on a drug industry. Of course, there are other companies with other, like what are the drugs these companies are primarily work on? It's not critical that they have to know the drug name, but it's important so that when they explain how they can add a value, they can at least break up that context together so that people would understand that, okay, here is what he has done, and how we can basically link to it on that way. And third thing, I always say ask questions, because it's so in general, in any interview process, we allow candidates to ask questions. So we know they have interest and engagement to about the job as well. So think about the questions that you have. Knowing about the job description and others, what are the questions they have before entering into the job? We give them that opportunity to ask. And of course, most companies need a job talk. Some people don't. Pharma still, the candidate need to present their work, where we evaluate the communication skill, how they interact with people. It's important to present the basic idea on a very simplistic manner, that what is the basic problem is. I mean, of course, many of them has done a phenomenal work, right? I mean, statistically, but understanding the problem, that what he's trying to solve and what he solved, I mean, so that people have that idea.
That is great advice, and it kind of circles back to your earlier advice on being prepared, which I think includes practicing, right? So I want to end with a question about lessons learned. And it sounds like a few years ago, you made a transition from a more clinical trials focused statistician to this consulting role. So it took a risk to make that transition. And I wonder if you could share one or two lessons learned from taking that risk.
Absolutely. I first mentioned one of the things that I learned is that the things I know, there may be things which is kind of a very evolving. So I need to find a way, learn quickly. My lesson learned as a consultant was, it's not possible always solving every problem perfectly, but we have to know how to solve this adequately and how we can train ourselves. So it's like continuous learning. I mean, I was not a Bayesian statistician, and there is a lot of Bayesian stuff coming in. So to me, it was a huge learning continuous. So when somebody moves to one job to another, it's very important to understand what they're getting into, and they need to kind of are ready for that mentally. Then second thing, other thing come up for a consultant to me, a lesson learned is when you are part of a trial, you get credited automatically. And now that's what exactly happens to my fellow members, right? You get awarded much, and because you're directly part of that. When you're a consultant, you work on a backline, and getting that recognition often become difficult. So it's very important that as a boss, when I work with my folks as a leader, I try to make sure that they get credited for their work. So at least their names goes into the publication, their names goes into the key. At least like some of the key achievement. I think one of the lesson learned is that's also talking upfront to clear out my expectation, what I expect at the end of the day from the team is very important. That sitting down there, that here is my expectation. When they clear out the expectation, also it's important to clarify the expectations that you have, which reduce a lot of confusion.
Wow, that is such excellent advice. We really appreciate you taking time to share all of these good thoughts with us. So, as regular listeners of Practical Significance know, we always want to know, though, what our guests are reading, listening to, watching. So, when you have free time, what good book are you reading? Podcast are you listening to? Movie are you watching?
Sure, I don't watch too much TV, but I watch movies and books and music. The recent movies I watched, I really like the movie Conclave. And I'm reading a book recently, which is called Hubris, The Rise and Fall of Future Humanity. It's very interesting. The book is referred by a friend of mine who is a biologist. It's kind of a telling they're tracking the DNA to understand how human came up to this point and what will happen in future. Very interesting book.
That's great. I'll give a thumbs up to Conclave as well. I listened to the audiobook and watched the movie, and I also thought it was great. Well, thank you very much to all of our guests for joining us. We have another tradition on Practical Significance, and that is Ron's Top 10. So now I'll turn it over to my colleague, Ron.
Thank you, Donna. As always, the Practical Significance podcast brings a statistical lens to the world. In this episode, we suggest the top 10 statistical concepts that would make great band names, along with what type of band would, in our humble opinion, best fit that band name. So here we go with the top 10 statistical concepts that would make great band names. Number 10, the autocorrelations, a country band where each song on an album sounds a bit like the previous one. Number 9, recursive partitioning, a progressive metal band that keeps splitting into smaller bands. Number 8, The Outliers, punk rock group known for distancing themselves from other bands. Number 7, Kolmogorov Smirnov. All other EDM groups compare themselves to this popular Russian band. Number 6, Multicollinear, a K-pop group with particularly unified choreography. Number 5, The Boxcox Transformation. It's the same type of band as Postmodern Jukebox. Number 4, Spurious Correlation, a pair of seemingly harmonious classical guitarists who are actually held together by their bass player. Number 3, Fat Tails, a rather extreme blues band. Number 2, Monte Carlo and the Markov Chains, a Vegas act whose music features unique sampling techniques. And the number 1 statistical concept that would make a great band name, the Confounders. It's hard to sort out what genre this group plays. And that's it for this episode of Practical Significance. We look forward to continuing the conversation next month.
We are Sitel. We are the world's leading data science CRO, with global experts in trial design, biostatistics, analytical methods, evidence, value, and access, positioned on every continent. Our services and software support your drug development through consultation and customized partnerships, illuminating your therapeutic journey through every phase, for every patient, advancing the future of human health. Sitel. Your success, our methods.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Significance, the podcast of the American Statistical Association. A new episode will be coming your way next month from AmStat News, the ASA's monthly membership magazine.